Introduce yourself, please.
Joe Don McGaugh, State Representative, 39th District. I represent Ray, Carroll, and Sheridan counties in the Missouri House.
Excellent. Let's get started. This is Statehouse Blend Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee and donuts to better understand the Missouri General Assembly, the people, and the issues in Jefferson City. Here we go. Welcome to the production studio at KCUR 89.3 for Statehouse Blend Missouri. That's right, we are a separate feed now from Statehouse Blend Kansas. But the same great content, we hope. Certainly off to a good start with Representative Joe Don McGaugh here, Republican from Carrollton, and also with Jason Rosenbaum, who's joining us by phone from St. Louis Public Radio. Hi, Jason.
How's it going?
Good to have you here. So, Joe Don, last time you were here, you told us about your family and pets and all of that, I'm sure. How are they? How's everyone doing?
Good. Wife Cassie's still teaching first grade. Nora Kate started kindergarten. Vivian's in preschool, and Gemma will be one in October. Growing family.
Getting to be a full house.
It is.
How's your district doing up there in Carroll County?
You know, I represent mostly an agriculturally related district. We had a fairly good year. It's what I was telling you on the way here. You know, you're seeing guys in the field shelling corn and doing those things. So it's an exciting time in our district. Our high school football team's only lost one game. So things like that are important in my part of the world. So everything's going pretty well.
Excellent. Well, how are things in St. Louis, Jason?
It's a little cloudy here, but I ran a 5K yesterday in 23 minutes and 8 seconds, so I'm doing great.
Well, you are doing great. Is that a personal best?
No, last year I ran it in under 23, so I think the combination of covering a special election here and drinking two beers the night before lowered my time by 30 seconds.
Well, it's also, strangely, that's generally considered the best way to prepare for Statehouse Blend, also with two beers and running a 5K. So
absolutely.
I'm glad it worked out. So the big news, of course, this week has been the veto override session in the Missouri General Assembly. Lots of news out of there. I think the big news would be that the Republican majority in both the House and the Senate was able, for the most part, to override the governor's vetoes at will. Not every bill, but almost all of them. You captured this pretty well on Twitter, I have to say, Joe Don McGaugh, with the hashtag that a lot of folks were using, Jay has no say. And indeed, the governor did not get a lot of say on a lot of bills. What's the big takeaway for you from this session, this one-day override session?
I think that, you know, the biggest thing is that the Republican supermajority kind of righted the wrong that we saw Governor Nixon do with his vetoes. We felt like there was a lot of common sense legislation that helped everyday people in Missouri. And we felt like, you know, that's why we have a supermajority, because Jay Nixon sort of lost touch with all of Missouri, really. So we had a strong veto session. There were some things that we didn't bring up and we didn't override that we'll continue to work on next year. And even though I said Jay has no say, several people on Twitter brought it to my attention that the very next day he did withhold several millions of dollars out of the budget. So, you know, the old saying, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Jay Nixon is that hammer, and the nail is the budget. Unfortunately, the people that affects are kids in education and in this instance, transportation and people involved in agriculture.
And the $50 million or so he withheld from the budget, he said he was doing because the vetoed legislation, which was overridden regarding tax exemptions for disaster relief for farmers, he says that presents too great a risk to the budget. That $50 million has to be accounted for some other way. You don't see it that way?
I don't. And there were some other things that we overrode that I think the governor had shed some light on. Representative Denny Hoskins' bill with ESOPs, with employee stock benefits. You know, that's a job creator. That was an economic development bill that we felt, you know, needed to be overridden. And then the other bill was Senator Krause, who had the bill about taxation on exercise facilities, basically. So we felt like those are things that we'd worked on all year that we didn't feel the governor had engaged on. And then right afterwards, Scott Fitzpatrick, who's the incoming budget chairman, you know, he agreed with, I think, most of the Republicans, saying that the governor had maybe acted in haste a little bit. and that he needed to kind of put the brakes on and see what was going to happen with the budget picture from now until the end of his term. So I think it was a little bit vindictive on the governor's part. I guess when you're the most overridden governor in the history of the state of Missouri, I guess it's your right to be vindictive.
The most tended to pieces of legislation that you were considering on Wednesday was the governor's veto of the permitless concealed carry bill, included the stand your ground language. The majorities in both the House and the Senate did override the governor's veto, so that very soon citizens of Missouri will not be required to have permits to carry concealed weapons. That was not without controversy beforehand. Obviously, that bill was criticized by law enforcement. Republican majority pressed ahead. There was some pretty strong reaction afterward. Let's take a listen to a statement at the press conference afterward by Senator Gail McKen Beatty, a Democrat from Kansas City.
We talk about our police officers and their safety. We just opened up a bill that's going to make it more unsafe for them. We talk about Black Lives Matter. We just made it open season.
Joe Don McGaw, do you think that this bill makes it open season on law enforcement, on Black Lives?
I couldn't disagree more. Much like what Jason said, I've spent some time in the Capitol and been kind of a political junkie for a long time, even before I started in the Senate. And, you know, we heard the same thing back when we implemented concealed carry. We heard the same thing in 2006 when they approved the Castle Doctrine in Missouri, and then we heard the same thing this year, that there would be blood in the streets, that there would be a drastic increase in crime, that we would have more people who would have guns illegally, and there would be all these bad things happen. It hasn't happened yet. What this bill did in my mind was it allowed people who are legally carrying firearms now to have less regulation and to basically not become felons if they conceal their firearms.
But
what it does not do is the people who are illegally acting with guns, whether they aren't supposed to have guns or whether, you know, there's still the federal laws that are in place to keep them for background checks and those type of things. We didn't give any more rights to people who are acting illegally. What we did do was allow the people who are doing it right to not be considered felons when they conceal their firearms. And those are in the places where it was already legal to do so. So they still have the protections of courthouses and churches and schools and those things. So if a municipality wants to say, we don't want these people to carry concealed, then they can do that. So to me, while I appreciate what the Representative McKen Beatty said, I don't agree with what she said. And I think that it kind of got out of control with what the other side was saying.
But I mean, it was sheriffs saying it too. County sheriffs saying, we're not going to have the ability to keep guns out of the hands of people we know, for example, to be at risk of committing domestic violence with weapons.
What they said is we no longer have the ability to deny someone to conceal and carry. That's incorrect. Because you still have to go through the process if you want to get a permit for concealed carry. So if you want to carry in those places where it's already illegal to carry concealed, you still have to go through the class. You still have to go get a license from your local sheriff, which we strengthened the ability of sheriffs to only issue these licenses. No longer will we have to deal with the Department of Revenue, because you know the problems that we had there. In my mind, the sheriff's argument was a little bit moot in that people will still have to get a permit if they want reciprocity, if they want to go to Kansas or other states with their firearm. And again, municipalities who make it illegal to carry a concealed weapon without a permit, which is, I'm assuming more municipalities will now do that, you'll have to get the permit. So then again, the sheriffs will still have that power. And also, as I said, federal law, if you're a felon or if you've been involved with domestic violence, they will not have the ability to do that. The ATF will still be involved with those situations. So I think those arguments, to me, fall on deaf ears.
Jason Rosenbaum, as you look over the list of bills that were voted on in this override session, what stood out to you?
What the other bill that stood out to me besides the gun bill we've talked about is the photo ID implementation bill. And I use that terminology very purposefully because it's a two-pronged process. You have to pass a constitutional amendment that will be on the ballot in November for this bill that was overridden to go into effect. And that's based off a Supreme Court ruling, I believe, in 2006. That was interesting to me because ever since I started covering Missouri politics, this idea of you have to have a photo ID in order to vote has been a major Republican priority. And ever since that court case in 2006, for whatever reason, the legislature just has not been successful at passing another version of this. They did, I think, pass it in early 2010s, but I'm pretty sure what happened, that got struck down in court as well.
Right.
So this is really like a culmination of a longstanding priority that finally got past the finish line. And there was no doubt in my mind that this veto session was not going to end without this bill being passed.
Joe Don, you didn't have any doubt about it either, I assume?
No, I think the reason why it hasn't passed, at least since I've been there, is it's always been the number one bargaining chip in the Senate. They've used it to get right to work. They've used it to get other, higher priority bills. To me, it was something that I had supported. My mom's a county clerk in Carroll County, Missouri. I think that, a lot of election authorities on both sides of the aisle support the idea and the concept. I had always filed a bill that would just do away with the ability to use a utility bill, bank statement, or paycheck, because I understand the argument for, the 86-year-old grandmother who doesn't drive and maybe have lost her birth certificate, and I was concerned with that. And Representative Dogan worked hard to get some language in the bill that would allow for the state to help those individuals get those documents to get their license, and it also allowed, I'm not sure what the year is, but there's some exceptions in there, too, that if you're over a certain age, you don't have to show a photo ID.
Well, and the other exception is that a person can actually sign an affidavit and still cast a ballot.
And that's in statute currently. If the election workers know the people personally, that they can sign those documents. So, I think it's kind of like the gun bill. I think Jason's talked about this. I think that the Democrats especially said this is maybe something we can live with. And Governor candidate Chris Koster said it was probably something that he would have signed.
Let me talk about just a couple other bills. One of those I know is near and dear to you, Joe Don. You've often focused on agricultural issues.
You
and one of the vetoes that you worked hard to get overridden this week was the legislation that removed removed the opportunity for a citizen to be appointed to that commission, the Clean Water Commission, and created space more exclusively for the agriculture industry. The opponent said that was like the foxes guarding the hen house. But you worked hard to get that bill, that veto override. What do you say to the opponents who say this is taking power out of the people's hands and putting it in industry's hands?
Well, when you hear on the House floor that we're putting hands or power in the hands of the polluters, I know no farmer out there who wants to pollute his own property. So I think that, to me, that's really, really frustrating. And I'm passionate about agriculture because that's where I grew up. It's the people that I represent. So also, there were some accusations that the veto should be sustained because the way that this came about, you didn't have a full and fair hearing on the issue.
It was an amendment attached on the floor,
correct,
towards the end of the session. There never was a hearing on that question.
But what happened was when 1713 was in the House, I put my amendment on the bill that would allow for clean water permits to be issued to entities who were in good standing with the state. When that went to the Senate, there were some senators who had some real issues with that. So what Senator Munslinger did is he negotiated for what the Senate does. He took that language off and put the language that became at issue in veto session on the bill. So when it came to veto session, and when people said this was the first time we had talked about this was snuck on in the middle of the night, that is blatantly false. We had fought, and it's what I said on the House floor, we had fought the Clean Water Commission all session. I had met with DNR at least three different times, and we talked about the Clean Water Commission. So when, the arguments that we heard, thankfully my colleagues didn't exactly listen to, but we felt like the agriculture needed a more representation on the board, and that's what we got. And I appreciate the work of Senator Munslinger and all the folks involved in ag to get that done. Hopefully that we'll have a voice on that and some of these clean water permit issues that we're trying to grow the economy in rural Missouri. They're not going to have those problems in the future.
But I mean, doesn't it seem like maybe agriculture should not, I guess I'm just voicing what I would imagine some people are thinking, which is maybe agriculture shouldn't be in charge of monitoring agriculture. That is, shouldn't there be some oversight that is not economically interested in the outcome?
That's why we have this, the mechanism whereby the governor makes the appointment and then the Senate, you know, ups or downs who goes on these boards. I mean, you can say that about any board.
Sure.
Shouldn't you not have funeral directors being in charge of the board of funeral directors and embalmers? I mean, that's every single issue. But what we're talking about is a board, it's a 7-people board, and we're saying 2 people have to be involved in agriculture. I don't find that to be unreasonable.
There's not a lot of opportunity during a veto session for people to make big statements or model protests, but there was over on the Senate side. One thing that happened is that Senator Jamila Nasheed remained seated during the Pledge of Allegiance at the opening of the session. She later would say that that was in solidarity with folks like Colin Kaepernick, as an expression of the idea that right now the nation isn't living into the fullness of its promises for liberty and justice for all of its people. You responded to that. You responded to that on Twitter. You actually posted a—well, here's what you said. You said, "My girls wanted—Senator Nasheed, my girls wanted me to send you something. We're proud of our flag and what it stands for." And you posted this video. Here's a little audio from that.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic.
And it's two of your daughters saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Look like you're choking up.
It does. I mean, it's tough for me. You know, I think about my grandfathers who were both military veterans. It's just, for a state senator to do that is just, to me, is just rough. You know, she's got the best bully pulpit probably in the state to do a lot of things. And I respect her. I mean, we've talked about a lot of issues. And, you know, for me, I when people make statements I that I don't agree with, you know, it's not that I want to lambast them for what their ideas and beliefs are, but it's almost sacred to me that we live in the country that we live in, and for people to make, you know, statements the way that they do, I just don't find it to be appropriate. So, you know, for me, when I've got 2 little girls who would do that, it's, you know, I felt like it was a pretty good response. So, you know, I try to teach my kids to respect everybody and respect people's ideas, but to me that wasn't a good day for the state of Missouri for her to do that.
Do you feel, I think there are some who would wonder about your daughters being brought into that as a response.
You know, Nora Kate started kindergarten. She went to a good Christian preschool where they said the Pledge of Allegiance. So that's what I thought about that day when I found out that she had not stood up to at least participate in the Pledge of Allegiance. She could have sat in the back chamber and, you know, issued a statement. But when I saw the video where she had stood up and then deliberately sat down, it just hit me a little bit, you know, that what we're seeing going on in San Francisco where, you know, multi-million-dollar athletes, you know, that I don't listen to politically what they say too much. You know, they can have their thoughts. But when a state senator, someone that I respect her, I respect what she does. I just thought there was a better way for her to do that. And I thought of my kids and what I want to teach them, and that's the easiest way I can make that statement.
Jason Rosenbaum, Senator Nasheed represents part of the St. Louis area. You, I'm sure, talked with some folks afterward about their thoughts.
I didn't talk to them about this. As I mentioned on the outset, my focus last week was covering this special election that was transpiring in the St. Louis area. I do know that it did get a lot of attention. It was on a lot of TV news broadcasts. And we obviously are in a situation in St. Louis that may be different from other parts of the state. We went through a pretty wrenching, you know, nationally watched situation in Ferguson where passions are still pretty raw and protests of all kinds have become pretty commonplace. Maybe not to what Senator Nasheed is doing, but in other forms of the governmental spheres, it has been. I haven't talked with her yet, so I would refrain from putting any words in her mouth other than what she has said to others. But I think that's probably from at least what I've seen her say in other outlets where she was coming from. And she just won re-election to her last term, so I don't know if there'll be any like practical political fallout for her. But obviously, some of her legislative colleagues, like the representative right now, didn't feel like it was a well-taken statement.
Well, let's talk about the upcoming election. Senator Nasheed is a good example of one of a handful of Democrats who are not facing opposition, and you, Representative McGaugh, are not facing opposition, but many of your colleagues are. What do you see happening to the makeup of the General Assembly here? Do you see any potential for significant shift, either in the numbers or in kind of the kind of legislature we become next year?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Senate, there may be, you know, plus or minus maybe a couple there. I think in the House, roughly going to be about the same. You know, we saw some incumbents who didn't win their primaries, and that's concerning to me a little bit. You know, you get to the point where your caucus grows so big, you start to kind of eat your own a little bit. And so that's a little weird.
I mean, you mentioned listening to State House Blend Kansas, yeah. Which we're glad you do. Thanks for listening. But obviously, there's a huge split in the Republican caucus on the Kansas side. Do you ever experience anything like that in the Missouri Republican caucuses?
Yeah, we do. You know, we have some disagreements, but I think the leadership that we have now with Speaker Richardson, I tell people his leadership is very intellectual. He doesn't try to strong arm people. He invites discussion, and we're trying to have those. You know, we consider ourselves a family, for lack of better terms, and we try to have those disagreements in a family type sitting. We try not to claw each other's eyes out on the House floor, but there are occasions when that comes up. But again, I think it's good for discussion. At the same time, sometimes on these issues, you know, we need to bring forward, shed more light on the issues. So I continue to see, I mean, you saw a veto session. We had a lot of cooperation among the Republicans and with help from the Democrats and independent as well. So I continue to see that happening, numbers being roughly the same. And then depending on what happens with the governor's race, the first part of session could be pretty fever pitched. And if we have another Democrat in office on the governor's mansion, it will probably be, I do think it will be a lot better situation than what we have now as far as input from the governor's office. So we'll just have to see how it plays out from the top.
Does not sound like you are feeling too negative about the possibility of a Governor Chris Coster.
No, I think, you know, as Jason said, when I worked in the Senate, when I was a staffer over there, he was a Republican. And he was pretty close with the senator that I worked for. So my experience with Chris Coster has been him as a Republican. And my experience with Chris Coster for him as Democrat Attorney General has been him fighting for the Second Amendment, fighting for farmers in the state of Missouri, and fighting against federal regulation. And the biggest example of that is when he fought President Obama's Clean Power Plan. So, you know, from what I've seen from Chris Coster, I can work with him.
Are you endorsing him?
I'm not endorsing Chris Coster. You know, I'm not exactly endorsing Eric Greitens either, I don't think. I've sat down and talked to Eric Greitens one time over a year ago. Since that time, he's called me and my colleagues corrupt, and he hadn't really backed away from that, and I understand that's how he won the primary election. So, you know, if it works for him, that's the way forward. I would say at some point he's going to extend the olive branch, and I'd hope that he would work with his Republican brethren.
That was the closest I've heard to an endorsement of the Democrat without saying you're endorsing the Democrat.
Yeah, you know, I didn't endorse anybody in the Republican primary. I know I can work with Eric Greitens. I know we can meet on some common ground on some things. I just don't know what those things are right now. I know. Well, let's say right to work. I know he's a supporter of that. Other than that, I know he likes to shoot big guns, and I do too. And maybe we can talk about that.
Well, in fact, let's do talk about candidates for office who like to shoot big guns. Because I actually want to get both of your reaction to something going on in the U.S. Senate race. The NRA has endorsed Senator Roy Blunt. They've criticized Jason Kander. But this week, Secretary of State Jason Kander, who's running for the U.S. Senate, the Democratic nominee, came out with a new ad that, well, it's gotten a lot of attention both around the state and nationally. Let's take a listen to that, and then I want to get your reactions.
I'm Jason Kander, and Senator Blunt has been attacking me on guns. Well, in the Army, I learned how to use and respect my rifle. In Afghanistan, I'd volunteer to be an extra gun in a convoy of unarmored SUVs. And in the state legislature, I supported Second Amendment rights. I also believe in background checks so that terrorists can't get their hands on one of these. I approve this message because I'd like to see Senator Blunt do this.
And of course, what's happening in this ad is that Jason Kander is blindfolded for most of it while he is putting together this military-style rifle. At the end of it, he takes off the blindfold when he says he'd like to see Senator Blunt do that. Jason Rosenbaum, Washington Post column, called this the best ad of the U.S. Senate campaign so far. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's a really effective ad, and I have to give Jason Kander a little bit of credit for making an ad on statewide Missouri television saying that he supports some form of gun control. You've seen a lot of Democratic candidates, especially statewide candidates, and even legislative candidates who kind of shy away from saying, I support a Democratic position on something. So in that instance, it was kind of a clever way of doing what I just said. What I found interesting, and I mentioned this on Twitter, is, and I'm kind of going to just use more than 140 characters to express this sentiment, is I believe that this is being done because there's a segment of the Democratic Party in Missouri that revile the National Rifle Association. And I think that this is trying to, A, neutralize that, but also say, like, Roy Blunt's association with the NRA is somehow a negative. Yet you have in the governor's race the Democratic nominee embracing the fact that he was endorsed by the National Rifle Association, probably doesn't support this policy that Jason Kander is talking about. And it just makes me wonder if the same people who are cheering Jason Kander on are going to criticize Chris Koster for basically doing the same thing Roy Blunt is doing, and that is kind of associating himself with the National Rifle Association. I realize that's a very complicated argument to make, and people watching that ad on television probably aren't putting that calculus together, but it kind of just goes part and parcel with the messaging that I see from the Democratic Party, which is not exactly in a straight line right now with those two candidates.
Right. It's very difficult to imagine two candidates more different than the Republican gubernatorial candidate Eric Greitens and the Democratic Senate candidate Jason Kander, and yet here are two very prominent ads that are getting a lot of attention that both really pretty much latch on to their fascination or their appreciation for guns. Joe Don, what did you think of the ad?
You said it was the Washington Post?
Yeah, the Washington Post had a column, Chris Saliza, that said it was the best ad in the campaign so far.
I'd say it's the biggest farce in the campaign so far. And I tweeted after I saw it, I said, I don't know what the big deal is. Jason Kander's had his blindfold on running the Secretary of State's office for the last 4 years. So, I mean, he didn't support the Second Amendment when he was in the legislature, number one. I think for him to do what he's doing now, I mean, I think it says a lot about his campaign, number one.
And why do you say that? What particular legislation are you citing there?
Well, I think from what I don't have the particular legislation. I mean, I think if you look at his rating on Second Amendment issues, I think that'll answer your question. I didn't serve in the legislature with him, but I have been, like I said, I've been involved on the elections committee over the last 4 years. I've seen the way his Secretary of State's office has ran. I think, as I said, my mother's a county clerk. Just this week, I don't know how many election officials came out and endorsed Roy Blunt, but it's a bipartisan group of election officials across the state. So you have to look at what the people have done in the past, not what they say they're going to do, or you know what they say in political theater, which I think is what this ad is. Jason Kander doesn't need to be promoted to the U.S. Senate, and I think the ad kind of clouds the issue.
Before we go, Jason Rosenbaum, you have any other questions for Joe Don McGaugh?
Yeah, since I'm kind of absconded in urban Missouri, I'm curious why you think Donald Trump is doing so well, maybe in outstate Missouri, because I'll be the first to admit that I didn't think that he was going to win the nomination, and I didn't think he was going to have appeal in large sections of the state, because when you look at his persona, he obviously now is being cast as like this defender of blue collar, you know, American values, so to speak. But his reputation for the last 20 or 30 years has been this eccentric, thrice married billionaire from New York City who doesn't really have like a whole lot personally in common with people say in Carroll County or even Jefferson County, yet he seems to be doing really well there. Like, do you have any insight on why that's the case?
You're shaking your head.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, like I said, during the when the presidential race started, you know, when Donald Trump entered the race, it was kind of like, yeah, well, that's, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch that, you know, see what he says. Because I think you had some good candidates at the top with Rubio and Cruz and across the board. I mean, I thought there were some pretty great candidates. And, you know, at the debates and things, that he basically said the things I think a lot of people, you know, in the back of their mind is like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And I think with him, like I said, being unbridled about it and the media getting behind him, and he was on the news every day, and it just seems like he could just say whatever and it was everywhere. So I think he just, a lot of times, and you know this in politics, it's about picking up steam at the right time. And I think everything just kind of worked out for him. And again, I think he's been a very successful businessman. When I look at his kids, I'm very impressed with what I see. And I think the back of, you know, here I am getting emotional when I hear my kids say the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, I think you can tell a lot about a person by the product that they deliver. And I think your kids are kind of your number one product. And I'm just real impressed with what he's brought forth there. So I think he can do a lot of great things for our country. You know, I'm 32 years old. As far as my working career, Barack Obama's kind of been it. And I'm a little bit pessimistic about the next 4 years if we have someone in office who has done what Barack Obama's done. So I'd like to see a businessman in the White House, and I want to see what he can do for our country.
Jason Rosenbaum and Joe Don McGaugh, I understand you two know each other from before your days in the state legislature. Is that right?
That is true.
That's true.
I'll just tell the anecdote. So Joe Don and I were both in fraternities at the University of Missouri Columbia, and my fraternity, Alpha Epsilon Pi, when I was pledging as a sophomore, was homecoming partners with Joe Don's fraternity, AGRO. And one of the things that I remember pretty distinctly is, since I was a pledge, I had to go to the basement of AGRO and basically put like colored tissue paper and a pattern for our house decks. And the joke I like to say, like that Joe Don is probably getting sick of me saying by now, is I'm sure he was one of the people yelling at me to keep pomping while I was pomping with everybody else. So, I mean, I don't know if that's actually true, because I was so focused on making sure that pattern was immaculate that I didn't really socialize as much as I should have. But we are basically, I think we're both 32. We were in the same grade at Mizzou. So I always am very, very happy with when somebody who is within my age range manages to get into politics, so to speak.
Joe Don, do you wish to confirm or deny that were berating a young Jason Rosenbaum as he decorated a float for the homecoming parade?
I would probably admit to that being true, yes. And I remember Jason from my time at Mizzou, because he wrote for the Maneater, and I can remember reading his columns, and I told him, you know, probably five people, you know, I'm exaggerating there, but
right, it's probably more like four people.
Yeah, so, yeah. And then I remember when he worked for the Tribune when I was in Jefferson City, and can remember read, and I think on Twitter I've sent Jason links to like former stories that he wrote about, because I'm just like, Jason and I have that, we share that like political nerd thing where we remember these things from 2006, 2007, and we're 32 years old. So again, we've both probably ended up good places for what we've desired in the past. And I know Jason's worked really hard and he's done some cool things. So it's great.
Yeah.
Jason Rosenbaum of St. Louis Public Radio, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Representative Joe Don McGaugh, Republican from Carrollton, thank you for being here as always.
Always a pleasure.
And as always, you have the opportunity to end our show with the music of your choice. What are you going to go with this time?
given that this week was veto session and the Republicans again righted the ship in the state of Missouri, I felt like the most appropriate song was Bachman Turner Overdrive, Taking Care of Business.
Taking Care of Business. That is a respectable choice. Thanks so much. Before we go, just want to remind our listeners that our show now operates as two separate podcasts, Statehouse Blend Kansas and Statehouse Blend Missouri. So if you have been subscribed previously to just one of them, it was probably now called Statehouse Blend Kansas. You need to subscribe to Statehouse Blend Missouri by going to iTunes or Google Play or wherever you get your podcasts and searching for Statehouse Blend Missouri. That's how you can keep up on issues in the Missouri General Assembly. Sam Zeff will continue covering everything in the Kansas legislature on the feed called Statehouse Blend Kansas. So look us up. Don't miss out on any episodes. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. If you use Twitter, you can keep up on the show, and you can follow me at PTS Brian. You can follow Statehouse Blend Kansas host Sam Zeff at Sam Zeff. You can find a shorter version of us on the air every Tuesday morning on KCUR 89.3. That's on Up to Date with Steve Kraske at 11 a.m. Any other thoughts on the program, write to me. I'm at brian@kcur.org. We'll see you next time on Statehouse Blend Missouri.